Support for this public radio podcast comes from KeyBank Capital Markets, specializing in corporate and investment banking solutions for established and growing mid-sized companies. Visit key.com/KBCM. And by Society for Human Resource Management, HR, leading people, leading organizations, shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937, Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
2.5 weeks ago, the Federal Reserve bailed out Bear Stearns. $29 billion worth of loan guarantees later, J.P. Morgan had itself a nifty little acquisition. Today, we got to hear firsthand why. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Grant Thornton, serving their audit, tax, and advisory clients worldwide with people who love what they do. Online at grantthornton.com. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Thursday, the 3rd of April. Great to have you here. The long green witness table in front of the Senate Banking Committee was crowded today. Left to right, you had the chairman of the Federal Reserve, the chairman of the SEC, an undersecretary of the Treasury, and the president of the New York Fed. In fact, it was too crowded because this guy had to wait until panel number two.
My name is Jamie Dimon. I'm the chairman and chief executive officer of J.P. Morgan Chase.
Dimon echoed what every other witness said today, that if he hadn't snapped up Bear Stearns with some help from the Fed, it would have been nothing less than the financial apocalypse.
The key point in my view is this. Bear Stearns would have failed without his effort, and the consequences could have been disastrous.
So we asked Marketplace's Bob Moon to do a little what if.
Billionaire investment guru Jim Rogers was furious as he spoke to Marketplace when news of the Bear Stearns rescue first broke.
You're telling me that people who make mistakes aren't supposed to go bankrupt? That is not capitalism. That's socialism for the rich.
But today, the head of the New York Federal Reserve Bank, Timothy Geithner, who helped put the deal together, insisted it wasn't just wealthy investors the government had to protect.
A failure to act would have added to the risk that Americans would face lower incomes, lower home values, higher borrowing costs for housing, education, other living expenses, lower retirement savings, and rising unemployment.
Critics have been arguing that meddling in the market will make higher interest rates and inflation inevitable for years to come. Again, Jim Rogers.
There's nothing wrong with bankruptcy. There's nothing wrong with financial collapse. It cleans out the system, and then you can start over again.
Wall Street historian Charles Geist says in past financial panics, one bloodletting has usually been enough for the market to right itself, but he's convinced things are very different now.
This problem is so systemic and endemic, it stretches everywhere. To let Bear Stearns go and then eventually have had to come in and bail someone else out who might have been a little bit larger would have been seen as favoritism or political, and it just wouldn't have made any sense.
Treasury Undersecretary Robert Steele called Bear Stearns a special case, but Alabama Republican Senator Richard Shelby wasn't convinced.
Well, we can't send the signal. If you take the risk and you're too big to fail, the Fed's going to come running, and the Treasury's going to back it, and the taxpayer's going to be on the hook. Can we?
No, sir.
Steele and other officials conceded, though, there could be further failures of banks deemed too big to fail. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The Senate's still debating its fix for the housing industry, but the smart money on Wall Street has already bought into better times. Our New York Bureau Chief Jill Barshay reports.
Even the stocks of the shakiest home builders rose 5 to 7% today. Parrish Glover tracks the industry at Morningstar. He says Wall Street is betting on home builders because Congress may take steps to prop up the housing market.
For an industry where cash generation has been minimal, it's absolutely huge.
The Senate is debating a $6 billion tax break aimed at home builders. The bill would also give Americans a $7,000 tax credit for buying a newly built home. Paul Puryear is director of real estate research at Raymond James. He says if you think Wall Street is out of its mind, you're right.
We are in a housing bust. There is no fundamental reason to buy these stocks. The fact that there's been some strength in the stocks is all about anticipation.
Housing stocks are still down more than 50% from their highs a year ago, according to Morningstar's Glover.
It's not so much that Wall Street's optimistic about home building. it's Wall Street is far less pessimistic. You know, we were concerned that some of these companies would be filing for bankruptcy within a few months, and now it looks like they've gotten a little bit of a longer leash.
Indeed, Wall Street is banking on more losses. In order to qualify for Washington's proposed tax break, builders have to report a loss this year. In New York, I'm Jill Barchet from Marketplace.
As the week winds down, here's the thing to remember about Wall Street. It hasn't given back Tuesday's 400-point gain. Yet, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. If you want to be at the head of the line come tax rebate time, direct deposit's the way to go. The IRS says electronic rebates are going to start going out on the 2nd of May. Commentator and behavioral economist Dan Ariely says the government might not realize it, but the way we get our cash is going to affect the way we spend it.
The U.S. government's recently announced $153 billion stimulus package is supposed to rejuvenate the economy and stabilize the market. Will the current plan achieve its goal? That depends. The field of behavioral economics has rather convincingly shown that money given in different forms can have different effects. For example, paying for dinner in cash feels very different than paying the same bill with a credit card. And an increase in monthly salary has a different effect on a person's spending than the same amount in an equivalent yearly bonus. These results suggest that how you deliver the stimulus package will have a considerable effect on how the money is spent. Individual tax relief is different than tax rebates, which is different from giving money toward retirement savings, gift certificates, or prepaid debit cards. Given that the method of delivery could make a large difference, which approach should we choose? The reality is that we just don't know, which is why we should conduct an experiment. We forced drug companies to test the efficacy of their drugs before rolling them into the market. So shouldn't we ask the government to first test its ideas before it invests billions of dollars of our tax money into some stimulus package? Experiments like these aren't easy to do. But in order to learn what is truly most effective, we must select a few possibilities. We should try them out in different markets or market sectors and compare their effectiveness over time. For instance, I suspect that giving people a prepaid debit card will do more to rejuvenate the economy than mailing out checks, but direct deposits wouldn't be nearly as effective. I also suspect that if we added a line on a debit card that reads, "Spend the government's money," this would work even better. The investment in experimentation like this would be modest compared with the value of an effective stimulus package that does what it's supposed to do.
Dan Ariely is professor of behavioral economics at MIT. His new book is called Predictably Irrational. Send us your thoughts, rational or not. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. The hottest thing in the Olympic pool this summer is going to be a $550 swimsuit. It's Speedo's latest high-tech creation called the Laser Racer. World records have been falling all over the place this spring. Diana Nyad is here to tell us more about that. Hey, Diana.
Kai, how are you?
I'm all right, thanks. So these suits, how do they work?
Well, you know, they've been making, number of companies have been making, you know, long suits, different from the suits we grew up seeing on Olympic swimmers for years, about a decade now. They call them the fast skin, et cetera. But these particular suits have a brand new technology. They're ultrasonically produced seams, so there's not a stitch in them. There's a giant compression factor around the core of the body. We look at these swimmers and think, there's no body fat to compress. But the truth is, once they start trying to take thousands of seconds off their time, it used to be just shaving the body was enough. But now, you know, the way they're actually building the panels and the seams of this suit, I wore one. It just feels like you are, as Michael Phelps said, it feels like you are a rocket, a torpedo going through the water.
You actually felt faster when you were swimming?
Oh, I wasn't, just didn't feel faster. I timed myself. I mean, at this old age, I was actually moving through the waters like I used to.
Well, we'll get to you and your history in this, because it's actually a good point of discussion. But these suits aren't cheap to begin with.
They're retailing for $550.
So nobody, I mean, I'm not going to wear one, right?
No. And you know what? The companies don't care. They want the unique, you know, experience of being called a champion. And just that public relations is what they're investing the money in.
And if Michael Phelps breaks the Mark Spitz record of 7 golds at the Olympics, then Speedo will obviously capitalize on it.
They'll capitalize on it. And I don't think anybody will be able to point a finger and say, oh, Michael Phelps never would have done that without the suit, because we've been watching him for years break world records. But listen, Kai, 14 world records in swimming in the last 6 weeks. That is unheard of, unprecedented. It takes a mountain to break one world record per year.
All right,
14 in 6 weeks.
Yep. So here's where you come in. Let's remind folks of your swimming background. You hold, what is it, a distance world record, or you did for many, many years?
Yeah, I was a great ocean swimmer and still hold the world record for the longest
just for the record. There you go.
In history.
All right, but let me ask you this, though. Is it a competitive disadvantage for a swimmer not sponsored by Speedo, who doesn't have one of these whiz-bang suits? You know, is that hurting them in competition?
I'd have to say so.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's Speedo that decided 4 years ago to put multiples of millions of dollars into their research and development on this particular suit. They're the ones who took the chance, and they're the ones now who are going to, you know, get paid off for it. So if you're from a country where the country has a manufacturing deal with someone who's making a bunch of suits, they can copy this, but they don't have this patented technology.
Now, are these guys cheating by wearing these suits?
No, they're not cheating. It's just like saying, you know, as a golfer cheating by using the most powerful clubs they can get, as a pole vaulter cheating by using the best new boron composite pole. No, you still have to have a feel for the water. You still have to put in the work. And, you know, it would be nice if everybody could get in the same suit. I will say that.
Diana Nyad, our own world record holder with the Business of Sports. Thank you, Diana.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up, struggles of a cargo crew in Dubai.
He's saying 4 years ago his boat drowned, four guys died, and he was in the water for 30 hours.
But first, let's do the numbers. Not much movement for the major indices today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials inched up 0.1%, 20 points to end the day at 12,626. The Nasdaq basically traded flat, up a single point to finish at 2,363. The S&P 500 nudged up 0.1%, 1 point, closed at 1,369. Schering Plough's decision to cut 10% of its workforce was just the right medicine for the drug maker stock. It improved 11%. A downgrade from UBS pushed Cisco Systems lower today by nearly 3%. Analysts cited weaker corporate demand for the company's computer networking equipment. And rumors of a sale boosted National City. Shares in the faltering bank deposited a 6% gain on news that rival KeyCorp might swoop in for a buyout. Bonds were higher. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.58%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Advanta. Advanta salutes small business, the brave ones, the risk takers, all those who chase a dream and make their own way. By Reuters, the world's daily news and information source. Before it's news, it's Reuters. And by Clarkson Potter's The Splendid Tables How to Eat Supper, the cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat. Available April 8th. Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a glance at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the unemployment report for March. Later on Capitol Hill, the Joint Economic Committee holds a hearing to look at those new unemployment numbers. And Oscar nominee Heath Ledger was born on April 4, 1979. The Australian actor would have been 29. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Pick up almost any investment book, and someplace in the first couple of pages, it'll probably say this: past performance is no indicator of future success. That has certainly been true over the past 6 or 8 months. Maybe everything will get back to normal soon. But there are some who say the financial system as we know it is broken. Investor and philanthropist George Soros is one of them. He's got a new book out offering what he calls a new paradigm for the financial markets. Mr. Soros, good to have you with us.
A pleasure.
You're a guy who knows a little bit of something about the markets, and I'd be curious as to your thoughts on why we came to the point we're at. How did the system fail?
Well, for the last 25 years, you've had this belief that markets are self-correcting, that you should leave them alone, and they'll take care of themselves. And it really has come to dominate the way the financial markets, the global financial markets, were allowed to develop in the last 25 years, creating what I call a super boom, which is now coming to an end.
Seems to me this is a pretty convenient time to argue that markets are inherently unstable.
Well, that is why I'm bringing it out, because the prevailing paradigm not only failed to explain what's going on, but actually caused what is going on, because all those newfangled instruments that you were describing, these credit default swaps and the collateralized debt obligations, they are all built on this false conception that deviations are random.
And you don't think they are?
No. What the people who created these various mortgage securities didn't take into account is that their creation of those securities will affect the value of houses, that you will have double-digit increases in houses, which is a boom, to be followed by a bust.
What do you think of Secretary Paulson's recommendations of earlier this week?
I think it misses the point, because you don't need to reshuffle the deck chairs. You do need to do all the things that the Fed is doing, and you will actually need to do more, because you will have to use taxpayers' money to stop the decline in housing prices, because otherwise that decline will overshoot on the downside. House prices will overshoot on the downside in exactly the same way as they overshot on the upside.
I'm obliged to point out that you did pretty well for yourself in the foreign exchange markets 10, 15 years ago.
Yes, this is the theory that has guided me, because I think I understood that they are basically unstable, and I looked for the instabilities, and, you know, sometimes I got it right, and I was also looking for my own mistakes and corrected them.
What mistakes have you made?
Well, plenty.
How have you been doing? I mean, the last part of this book is actually interesting. It's a near real-time diary of how your investments are performing in the past couple of months. How are you doing?
Well, I'm managing to offset the losses that are being generated by all the people to whom I have given money to manage, because I've got I've farmed out most of the money. And then I came back and established a macro account. And I think in the current circumstances, that's quite an achievement, because we're living in a period of financial wealth destruction. So if you can just preserve your capital, you're doing well.
George Soros, his new book is called The New Paradigm for Financial Markets. Mr. Soros, thanks for your time.
Pleasure.
Take the global economy, strip it down to its component parts, and what you have is a single person doing a job trying to get by. Today on our series Working, where we explore the lives of individuals in that global economy, we take you back to Dubai and the oldest part of the world's newest financial capital. Along the banks of Dubai Creek, which is really more of a river, you can see dozens of traditional Arabian cargo ships called dhows. The crews come from all over the world, and so does the cargo. Some of those dhows are loaded with American-made goods being shipped to Iran, even though U.S. trade sanctions say that's not allowed to happen.
For the captains, though, it's about profits, not politics. Oh, and survival, too. Kelly McEvers has our profile.
The first thing that Hussein Ralib Esfandiari tells me about himself is that he has years of experience captaining a boat across the Persian Gulf. The second thing he tells me is that his job almost killed him.
He's saying 4 years ago his boat drowned. Four guys died, and he was in the water for 30 hours.
Hussein is 33, but looks at least 10 years older. The sinking is in my face now, he says. It's with me every day. Hussein's father, grandfather, uncles, they all did this work. They taught him how to navigate a rickety dhow with a compass and a watch. But Hussein doesn't like to think of himself as a boatman. He says he's a trader who buys things in one place and sells them in another. He takes me to Dubai's main market, a riot of languages and people in every conceivable national dress. Hussein says customs officials here don't care if he takes American goods to Iran. The Iranians don't care either.
USA? America?
Lately, though, he's looking for stuff that looks American, but was made somewhere else.
That's China.
Chinese goods he can buy for much less money. The next day, his four crew members load the boat with Chinese-made dishes, blankets, clothes, and shoes, and a handful of American cell phones.
I'm in.
Hussein steps behind the wooden steering wheel and radios his cousin out at sea. The weather's been bad for days, and he's waiting for it to clear before he sails. Hussein says before his old boat sank, he didn't used to worry about the weather. The accident happened around 2 in the morning. He'd been sailing for 2 days and had almost made it to Iran. Then a storm blew in. The boat hit an underwater pipe. Hussein radioed for help, but the boat was already sinking. He and a crew member named Hassan tied themselves to wooden pallets and floated through the night.
Around 10 a.m., helicopter comes, and he screams out for the helicopter, and nothing. They don't see them because there's water everywhere. And his friend, Hassan, started getting cold and started getting scared.
Hassan
held on for a few hours, but then died in Hussein's arms. Hussein steered himself toward a buoy, climbed on top of it, and waited there another whole night before the rescue boats came. Now he says a prayer before every trip. Hussein's been waiting in port for about a week. On this day, the weather's finally clear. He tells the crew it's time to sail. The interpreter, Tamara, and I want to sail with Hussein from Dubai to Iran. But that's not such an easy thing to do. First of all, we don't work in the shipping business, so we're not allowed to leave Dubai on a cargo boat. Second, even if we had visas to enter Iran, there's no way we could do that by boat either. So Tamara comes up with a plan. She asks a friend to take us out of the Dubai Creek in his speedboat.
Okay, so we're in our boat. Hussein has just cleared customs.
Our boat follows Hussein's boat out of the creek.
Beautiful clear day. Got boats going to Pakistan, Kuwait, Somalia, Oman.
Once we reach open water, we pull up to Hussein's boat and climb in. Our plan is to ride with him for an hour or so, then wish him a safe trip and jump into the speedboat and head back to Dubai. Hussein tells us he stayed up until 3 a.m. the night before, drinking tea and worrying that something bad might happen. Right about then, we realize we're being surrounded by two official-looking boats.
So, you know, we've just been stopped by police, and they think they're trying to take us to Iran or something. Everything's fine, I think.
But it's not fine. At first, we think they'll only take Tamara and me and let Hussein keep sailing.
Bye.
But then they order him back, too.
We want them to go back in as well.
No.
That night, Tamara, her friend, and I are interrogated by Dubai intelligence agents. We're told these are sensitive times between Iran and the U.S. We're released around midnight. Hussein and his crew remain in custody. Days go by before we reach him again.
Hello?
Hussein!
Hello!
I tell Hussein I'm sorry for causing him so much trouble and delaying his trip. Then he tells me he's grateful. That's because a huge storm came in that night. 15 boats sank. Hussein says the delay actually saved his life. He was able to anchor up and wait out the storm before sailing on to Iran. I couldn't get a visa to see Hussein there, so I asked an Iranian reporter to go to Ghanaway, Hussein's hometown in southwestern Iran. The reporter met Hussein at this scrappy open-air market. Hussein says he's found buyers for all his cargo. Now he's collecting the money that's owed him. In all, he'll net about $3,000 for 2 months of work. That's just enough to make payments on his new boat and support his sister and mother. The women live in a two-room rental with no furniture. Hussein's mother sleeps under the stairs. She's blind and nearly deaf. Every night I go and touch his bed, she says. If he's not there, I can't sleep. She says the sinking of Hussein's boat 4 years ago devastated the family. Back then, Hussein was engaged to a local girl, but she broke it off after the accident because he no longer had a way to support her. Now Hussein has a new fiancé. He told me about her after we first met. The new fiancé's one condition is that Hussein stop working on the boat, that he open a supermarket on land instead. I want to stop, he told me. I really do. But then he keeps on going. Last time I talked to Hussein, he was in Dubai, loading the boat for another trip. Like one of his friends told me, Hussein is like a crab. He likes to get out and walk around, but he always finds his way back to the water.
That was Kelly McEvers in Dubai for us. Her report was part of our series, Working. It's a co-production with Homelands Productions. For more on Hussein and some other workers we've profiled in the series, go to our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Shriners Hospitals for Children, providing treatment for orthopedic, burn, and spinal cord injuries at no cost to the families. More at ShrinersForKids.org. And by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note before we let you go, today we are pleased to be able to report that even as a private citizen, Elliot Spitzer is doing his part to help the economy. Washington's Mayflower Hotel reports that it's seen a nice spike in business lately, especially the gift shop. Bathrobes, mugs, mints, everything is popular. The former governor of New York spent some time there earlier this year. You might remember the Washington Post reports today items with the hotel's logo on them are flying off the shelves. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow skipped up 20 points, a tenth of 1%. The Nasdaq added 1 point. We'll call that basically flat. The S&P 500 rose a point. That is a tenth of 1% on that particular index. Kevin Arnovitz, Patty Hirsch, Karen Lowe, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. If you missed something on the radio today, we are podcasting. The link, of course, is on our homepage. It is marketplace.org. Coming up next time on the air, scientists, businessmen, and evolution.
If you have questioned Darwinism, that's it. Your career is over.
I'm Kai Ryssdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.